All right, let's pick up where we left off in the first epistle of John. We left off in chapter 3 of 1 John. And for those of you who haven't been here when we started this particular book, this is the Apostle John, and he wrote these epistles, it's believed around 90-95 AD, and he wrote them to all the churches, but basically he wrote it from Ephesus and the surrounding churches there. But he definitely has written these epistles to believers. There's no question about it that he's addressing those who have committed their life to Christ or profess to believe in him. And just back 2,000 years ago, it's really no different from today in terms of the counterfeits that they had to deal with there. You've had it since the beginning. You've had it since Cain and Abel, where you've had people who lay claim to believing in God or belonging to God or being on God's side or whatever, however you want to phrase this. And sometimes you can't tell a nickel's worth the difference between the heathen and the so-called Christian because you look at what they profess to believe and you look how they act, and there's such a contradiction there that it really raises an eyebrow. Well, John is setting forth some acid tests to say, hey, listen, if you really claim to belong to Jesus Christ, well, you have to prove it. And basically, you prove it by your life. You can't prove it by your words, because even James tells us, he says, hey, it's not the hearers of the words that's going to be saved. It's a doer of the word. And when he says something like that, you got to consider that we're living in a country where we virtually have more churches than any country in the world. I mean, when you consider per population, we certainly do. And we certainly have the religious freedoms that virtually nobody in the world has ever enjoyed to our extent. Okay, you can go to almost any bookstore, pick up a Bible, and, we have this type of religious freedom. Granted, we are on the very verge of losing our freedoms. They're slowly being eroded away. Now it's becoming less and less fashionable to be a born-again believer, because now we are being termed as being fanatical or being right-wing extremists or being dangerous or being bigoted or prejudiced, whatever the situation. But nevertheless, in spite of all that, we can still see that we have enough freedom in this country to where people really can exercise it. But the problem is, we see a situation where if you take all these different polls, all these different surveys, we see that the overwhelming majority of people claim to believe in God, and even the majority of people in this country claim to be Christian. And yet we are in a situation where, obviously, okay, by reading the newspaper, looking at the news, and seeing what's going on in current events, that, this is just not the case. Because if it were the case, we wouldn't be in the moral mess that we're in today. So John is setting forth just an acid test to say, okay, this is a litmus test. This is where the rubber meets the road in terms of, do you really belong to God, or do you just say you do? Anyway, he says here in that beginning with verse 1 in this chapter 3 in 1 John, it says, see how great a love the Father has bestowed upon us that we should be called children of God, and such we are. For this reason, the world does not know us because it did not know him. First of all, he's just saying, okay, see how great a love the Father has bestowed upon all of us in the fact that he has called us his children. Now, when we read through this chapter, we're going to be reading at least, I think, half a dozen times where it says that people who are God's children are born of God. When you stop and think about it, okay, we are adopted sons of God. Okay, God has one begotten son, and that's Jesus Christ. The rest of us are basically adopted sons. But nevertheless, it says that we, are children of God, and John refers to it again and again as we are born of God. And that, to me, says an awful lot, because I think any woman who has given birth knows what it is, the type of pain and type of labor and a type of sacrifice that you go through to give birth. Well, in a sense, when we're saying that we're born of God, I mean, this isn't something flippant or shallow that we're talking about. This is something where it really costs God a great deal, to bring about our salvation, to bring about a situation where we could be called sons and daughters of God. We could be called children of God. This is something that we don't take lightly. And, we're living in a day and age where a lot of people think, well, we're all sons of God. I mean, we've heard this many times. I've heard it. I've heard it so many times I get nauseated by hearing it, that people think, well, anybody who's a human being is a son or daughter of God. Well, that just isn't the case. I remember that movie a long time ago. It was a funny movie called Oh God. You ever see that movie? It was a hilarious movie, but, its theology was really out the window. But I remember in one point where George Burns, who plays the part of God, he's talking to this store clerk. The store clerk asks him, is Jesus Christ your son? He says, yeah, Jesus Christ is my son. And then he says, but Muhammad's my son, and Confucius is my son. And, you know, and these other people are my sons, too. So, I mean, that was theology that just was really off the wall. But it really reflected the kind of mindset that people have today. They think that, hey, it doesn't matter what you believe and how you act and who you are. You can call yourself a son of God. Well, here John puts it more in perspective, that if we're going to become sons of God or children of God, we have to be born of God. We have to be born again in Christ to become partakers of God's salvation. So he's saying this, that see how great a love the Father has bestowed upon us that we should be called children of God, and such we are. For this reason, the world does not know us because it did not know him. I think that's pretty significant. The world doesn't know us because it doesn't know him. Now, I just mentioned in kind of the introduction to this chapter how more and more we're seeing our religious freedoms being eroded away to the point now where I can see the handwriting on the wall where Christians, I mean, committed Christians, dedicated Christians, born-again Christians who are really obeying Christ, well, they are referred to as being fanatical or being dangerous or being bigoted or being extremist, intolerant. I mean, this, you know, you can come up with all these different kinds of adjectives or words to try to describe what we're being called today. Well, we're being called these very names by the very people who claim to believe in God. But the interesting thing is if you read the last sentence of the verse 1, it says, for this reason, the world does not know us because it did not know him. They claim to know him, but they don't. Why? Because they don't obey him. Jesus himself said, those who don't obey me, they don't belong to me. Well, if they don't know him, they don't know us. And they're going to lambaste him and they're going to lambaste us. So it says in verse 2, it says, Beloved, now we are children of God, and it has not appeared as yet as what we shall be. We know that when he appears, we shall be like him because we shall see him just as he is. Now I think that's very, very profound. We don't know what we're going to look like. We don't know what our nature is going to be exactly like when we get to heaven. When we get to heaven, we're going to have, you know, a resurrected body. And what that is going to entail, I don't really know. But it says here that we're going to be able to see him as he is because we're going to be like him. Now, let me clarify this. We're not going to be like God in terms of being divine. I do believe we will share in his divine nature, but I want to clarify this, okay? That does not suggest in any way, shape, or form that we are little gods or gods or anything like that. What I mean by a sharing in his divine nature is this, okay? When it says that we will be like him, it means that we will be like him in his moral character. We will be like him in his righteousness and his goodness. I mean, I don't know if anybody here has entertained this thought, but sometimes it just has literally tormented me sometimes. I'm living in a fallen world, in a fallen body that has a fallen nature, and my fallen nature naturally gravitates to what? To things of the world, the things of the flesh, to selfishness, self-centeredness, lustfulness, this type of thing. It naturally is there. We have to fight it day in and day out, right? And I think sometimes, you know, the struggle sometimes gets so tiresome. Sometimes I wonder to myself, man, I can't imagine what it's going to be like in heaven not having to fight these temptations and not having to deal with this fallen nature. And sometimes I've thought to myself, what if I finally get to heaven and then sometime in eternity I blow it? You know, have you ever thought of that? And then what? You're going to get thrown out of heaven like the devil was? I mean, I know it sounds foolish, but sometimes the thought has tormented me. Like, gosh, you know, what if somewhere down the line in eternity I blow it? Well, when I read a verse like this, it convinces me that it's not possible. Why? Because I'm going to have a changed nature. Now, granted, Christ has changed my nature now, but the problem with my nature is, like Paul says, the spirit lusts against the flesh against the spirit. It wars against the flesh and it wars against the spirit. In other words, you know, we are in these fallen natures even though we have a new nature within us. And so there's a constant conflict between what our fallen nature wants to do and what God wants us to do while we are in this body of sin and death, while we are still in this world. But when we get to heaven, we're going to see him as he is because we're going to be like him in his moral perfection, so that it will be impossible for us to sin after we get to heaven. You know, that's a comforting thought. I don't know what you guys think about it, but, you know, if you really struggle with sin day in and day out, to me it's a very comforting thought. But anyway, you know, when we get there, it's going to be, to me, a glorious thing just to be able to shed the body of sin and death. Not only a body that is, let's say, it's prone to what? Sickness, disease, and finally decay and death and, you know, this type of thing. But we're going to have a body that's going to be transformed spiritually and physically. It's going to be a resurrected, perfect body. Okay. And he says in verse 3, it says, and everyone who has his hope fixed on him purifies himself just as he is pure. In that verse 3, can anybody pick out the one of the most important words in this verse 3? And everyone who has this hope fixed on him purifies himself just as he is pure.
Huh?
It's fixed. It really, I think the world is fixed. It's fixed. It means fixated. It means you've got your focus of attention on him. You've got your eyes on him. You've got it fixed on him. There's a psalm that says that God says, I will guide thee with my eye. And I think that's very profound, because if we are going to get wisdom, guidance, and direction in our life from God, we have to keep our eyes on him. I will guide thee with my eye. We can't be looking, you know, around us in terms of the world, looking in every other place, looking at every other person, every other government program, every other, you know, situation that the world has to offer. We got to keep our eyes on him, because if he's going to guide us with our eyes, if we got our focus on his countenance, on his face, and looking for him, then he's going to be able to guide us. But that's what it means. If we have our hope fixed on him, I mean, people got their hope where? Everybody's got their hope somewhere. They got their hope in the lottery. They got their hope in what? The piggy bank. They got their hope in the stocks. They got their hope in what? Their degree or their career or their material things or their home or whatever. Well, when it talks about having our hope fixed on him, it means that we're not relying upon anything else. Absolutely nothing else. I mean, there's a lot of people say, well, if there's a heaven, I hope to go there. That's not having your hope fixed on Christ, is it? I mean, I've seen a lot of people have that same kind of mindset, that same kind of attitude, or same kind of thinking. Well, if they're heaven, I hope I go there. You know, well, I hope you do too, but I don't think you're going to make it. Because why? You haven't got your hope fixed on Christ. If you get your focus of attention on him, get your hope fixed on him. Okay, what's going to be the end result? It says that you're going to purify yourself. Why? Because he is pure. All right? In other words, you get your eyes on him, and you're going to begin to reflect his nature. I've said this so many times, but it's so important that we realize this, that, you know, the Bible says, be not deceived, bad company corrupts good morals. If you're going to hang around with thieves, you're going to become a thief. You're going to hang around with blasphemers, you're going to become a blasphemer. You're going to hang around with the immoral, you become immoral, right? All right? Well, if you hang around with God, you're going to become godly. So if you read this, it says, verse 3, everyone who has his hope fixed on him purifies himself just as he appears. In other words, you're keeping company with him. And you're going to end up reflecting him. And in verse 4, it says, everyone who practices sin also practices lawlessness, and sin is lawlessness. We were talking about the other night about the definition of sin. And sin has become obsolete today. You know, I think it says an awful lot about our culture and our society when the only time that people use the word sin or sinful is when they're talking about a dessert. Do you ever think about that?
Yeah.
You know, they say, oh, that dessert is sinful. But, you know, you say, hey, that lifestyle is sinful, and look out, somebody's going to take off your head. You know, and we're talking about sin here. They say that sin is lawlessness. And I was talking about the other night as far as what sin is. It is an offense against God, because you break his laws. And when you break his law, you are offending him. So sin is an offense against God. But I thought, we're talking about these laws. And I thought it was very interesting. Do you know that that girl, Rachel Hunt, that not Rachel, I'm sorry. Rachel Joy Scott, the poor unfortunate girl that was murdered in Columbine High School. Well, her brother also was a victim in that shooting. And their father was a born-again Christian. And I got this off the internet from Randy Tomasekovich, but he gave a testimony. His name is Daryl Scott, and he gave this testimony before the Subcommittee on Crime in the House. I just want to read this to you. I don't normally read it, but I think this guy says so much, and we're talking about now sin. We're talking about lawlessness, and we're talking about the type of world that we live in. Just listen to what this guy said. First of all, it says, testimony of Daryl Scott, father of two victims of the Columbine High School shooting, Littleton, Colorado, before the Subcommittee on Crime, House Judiciary Committee, United States House of Representatives, etc. Then it says this. This is what he said. This is what he said before the House of Representatives. He said this: since the dawn of creation, there has been both good and evil in the heart of men and women. We all contain the seeds of kindness or the seeds of violence. The death of my wonderful daughter, Rachel Joy Scott, and the deaths of that heroic teacher and the other children who died must not be in vain. Their blood cries out for answers. The first recorded act of violence was when Cain slew his brother Abel out in the field. The villain was not the club he used, neither was it the NCA, or the National Club Association. The true killer was Cain, and the reason for the murder could only be found in Cain's heart. In the days that followed the Columbine tragedy, I was amazed how quickly the fingers began to be pointed at groups such as the NRA. I am not a member of the NRA. I am not a hunter. I do not even own a gun. I am not here to represent or defend the NRA because I do not believe that they are responsible for my daughter's death. Therefore, I do not believe that they need to be defended. If I believed that they had anything to do with Rachel's murder, I would be their strongest opponent. I am here today to declare that Columbine was not just a tragedy. It was a spiritual event that should be forcing us to look at where the real blame lies. Much of that blame lies here in this room. Much of that blame lies behind the pointing fingers of the accusers themselves. I wrote a poem just 4 nights ago that expressed my feelings best. This was written way before I knew I would be speaking here today. Quote, your laws ignore our deepest needs. Your words are empty air. You've stripped away our heritage. You've outlawed simple prayer. Now gunshots fill our classrooms and precious children die. You seek for answers everywhere and ask the question why. You regulate restrictive laws through legislative creed, and yet you fail to understand that God is what we need. Men and women are three-part beings. We all consist of body, soul, and spirit. When we refuse to acknowledge a third part of our makeup, we create a void that allows evil, prejudice, and hatred to rush in and wreak havoc. Spiritual influences were present within our educational system for most of our nation's history. Many of our major colleges began as theological seminaries. This is a historical fact. What has happened to us as a nation? We have refused to honor God, and in doing so, we open the doors to hatred and violence. And when something as terrible as Columbine's tragedy occurs, politicians immediately look for scapegoats such as the NRA. They immediately seek to pass more restrictive laws that continue to erode away our personal and private liberties. We do not need more restrictive laws. Eric and Dylan would not have been stopped by metal detectors. No amount of gun laws can stop someone who spends months planning this type of massacre. The real villain lies within our own hearts. Political posturing and restrictive legislation is not the answer. The young people of our nation hold the key. There is a spiritual awakening taking place that will not be squenched. We do not need more religion. We do not need more we do not need more gaudy television evangelists spewing out verbal religious garbage. We do not need more million-dollar church buildings built while people with basic needs are being ignored. We do need a change of heart and a humble acknowledgement that this nation was founded on the principles of spiritual trust in God. As my son Craig lay under the table in the school library and saw his two friends murdered before his very eyes, he did not hesitate to pray in school. I defy any law or politician to deny him that right. I challenge every young person in America and around the world to realize that on April 20th, 1999, at Columbine High School, prayer was brought back to our schools. Do not let the many prayers offered by those students be in vain. Dare to move into that new millennium with a sacred disregard for legislation that violates your conscience and denies your God-given right to communicate with Him. To those of you who would point the finger at the NRA, I give you this sincere challenge. Dare to examine your own heart before you cast the first stone. My daughter's death will not be in vain. The young people of this country will not allow that to happen again.
That was on the internet?
Yeah. Well, he gave this right before the United States House of Representatives.
I hope a million.
I wonder if anyone will ever sink into those dunderheads, though.
They're pretty dense.
Yeah. Right. Well, it definitely has shaken this nation up, and I like what he said there as far as, hey, on that day when these two were going around shooting people in his classrooms, these kids were praying. And he defies anybody to deny him that right to pray. But, you know, it's just a sad situation where we sow to the wind 30 years ago. Now we're reaping the whirlwind, and at least there's enough voices being heard, especially a man like this, to where some common sense is trying to be set forth in all this clamor. And the reason I even shared that is we're dealing with here, we're dealing with sin, and we're dealing with lawlessness. I mean, the two are interchangeable. We denied sin, right? We have denied sin. We have outmoded sin. It has become archaic. We don't want to use the word anymore. Okay, and so what happens? When people sin, we end up passing more and more laws to keep them from sinning. And what happens? But, you know, these laws aren't doing any good. They're just becoming more and more suffocating, more and more restrictive. And in verse 5 it says, verse 4 says, everyone who practices sin also practices lawlessness, and sin is lawlessness. Now here's the important thing, okay? The word practice is what's most important here. Because we all sin. As Christians, born again Christians, every one of us have this fallen nature. Well, we sin. But there's a big difference between sinning and practicing sin. Okay? Practicing sin is not just habitual. I mean, it's a lifestyle. It's what comes natural to you. I mean, this is the thing. I mean, a Christian every once in a while, you know, out of frustration or aggravation may, let's say, curse, or even maybe even use the Lord's name in vain, though then he has sinned, and so he needs to repent of that. But a person who practices, you ever been around a person with a foul mouth? Every other word that comes out of their mouth is F this, F that, GG this, GG that. I mean, that's, you know, you think, gosh, is that the only vocabulary you got? I mean, but that's all that comes out of their mouth. Why? Because they're practicing lawlessness. I mean, it's a second nature to them. In verse 5 it says, and you know that he appeared in order to take away sins, and in him there is no sin. And one who abides in him, and no one who abides in him sins. No one who sins has seen him or knows him. Little children, let no one deceive you. The one who practices righteousness is righteous, and just as he is righteous. The one who practices sin is of the devil, for the devil has sinned from the beginning. The Son of God appeared for this purpose, that he might destroy the works of the devil. Okay, let's just back up and break this down. Okay, he said that he appeared in order to take away sin. So we got to understand something, okay? Especially when John was writing this to the Christians in his day. I mentioned this earlier when we started this book, that they had to deal with a sect called the Gnostics. And Gnosticism basically means knowledge, or people who know things. And they basically claimed to have a higher knowledge. And then their knowledge was this. They taught that the body is sinful by nature, and therefore it cannot be redeemed. When you accept Christ, your soul is redeemed. Therefore, you can live up a storm, sin up a storm in your body, in your flesh, and it doesn't really matter because it's not going to affect your soul. Well, this was a damnable heresy that was being, you know, taught during John's day. And, of course, it's carried over today, only used in different terminology or different religious terms to justify it. But John is saying here, look, in verse 5, it says, you know that he appeared in order to take away sin, and in him there is no sin. So he came to do away with sin. So it's a contradiction of terms to think that, well, you know, Christ came to just take away sin, but he's going to allow us to live in our sin. Okay? Stop and think about it, okay? Because I really get a little exasperated with when I have to deal with people, or when I see what we have to confront people with when they want to hold on to their sin yet claim to be Christian. There's a whole group of people today who claim to be Christian homosexuals. Okay, now I want to carry that thought to its ultimate logical conclusion. If there's Christian homosexuals, then there's got to be Christian fornicators and Christian adulterers and Christian thieves and Christian murderers, okay, and Christian blasphemers and Christian atheists. You know, carry this absurd thought to its ultimate logical conclusion, right? I mean, the whole thing is absurd. These are contradiction of terms. You can't claim to be a Christian homosexual any more than claim to be a Christian adulterer. I know what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about practicing it. What I mean by practicing it, I mean this is your lifestyle. This is you living in this. You know, I'm not talking about, you know, every Christian's prone to fall, and they may fall in any of these areas, but they're not practicing it. And if they fall, they get up on their face, they confess their sin, and they go on. That's a lot different than living in their sin. You can't live in your sin and claim to belong to Christ. And believe me, there are a multitude of people that are doing that. And Jesus warned about us in Matthew 25, where he says in the last days, he says, there's going to be many who will say to me in that day, Lord, didn't we cast out demons in your name? Lord, didn't we preach in your name? Lord, didn't we do miracles in your name? Lord, didn't we do this and that in your name? He's going to say, depart from me, you practicers of iniquity. I never knew you. And I guarantee you that those words of his are going to be ringing through their ears for all eternity. I never knew you. you practices of iniquity. See, that's the key. Practice. The word practice means this is your lifestyle. You know, it always used to amaze me. Years ago, we used to go drive down Highway 80. It was this big sign, and it had a red palm on it. You know, you could see the palm lines in his hand, and it says, Madam Eve, or it was a Madam Walker. I think it was Madam Eve. Anyway, you know, I've talked to a person who actually went into pay money, good money, to listen to this, you know, windbag, tell him about the future, okay? But it's interesting that they said they went into her house, and it's kind of all dark, but there was a picture of Christ on the wall, and there was a Bible sitting on a desk, you know, and of course then all this other occultic paraphernalia all around, okay, plus the crystal ball, and then she's supposed to tell the future. But I'm thinking, well, here you got a typical classic example of a person who claims to, you know, to believe in God, and even claims that their power comes from God, yet they are living in iniquity. They are practicing sin. These are the type of people that Jesus is going to say, depart from me, you practicers of iniquity. I never knew you. Why? Because they're doing exactly what God has forbade them to do. But they have somehow justified it and rationalized it and excused it. Just like all these other people who want to live in their sinful lifestyle. We want to believe it. Why? Because our hearts are deceitful above all things, are desperately wicked. So we can plead the purity of anything, okay, as long as we want it. And the devil's right there to give us the lie. I mean, he's got a con for everybody, you know. And he knows how prone we are to fall for it, hook, line, and sinker, because we want to hear it. And so anyway, verse 6 says, no one who abides in him sins. No one who sins has seen him or knows him. This is very important because I've seen people, I've heard people, I've listened to people. They take this verse and then they come up with this cockamamie theology that says, hey, I never sin. Have you heard this? I've run across people who say, hey, I have never sinned. I accepted Christ and I have never sinned since. I say,
well, there's your big sin right there.
Right. Well, I say, man, what planet are you from? It says here, no one who abides in him sins. No one who sins has seen him or knows him. Okay, well, they take a verse like that and they take it completely out of context saying, well, I obviously don't sin. Here again, you know, people are just, it just amazes me that people have such a genius for getting themselves confused. What it really is saying, okay, if we are abiding in Christ, that's the divine order. Jesus said, abide in me and I in you. Well, if Christ is abiding in us, then we have the power, we have the supernatural power not to sin. I don't care how bad the temptation is. We can't say, well, gee, the temptation was just overwhelming and I couldn't handle it. Okay, because God will not allow us to be tempted beyond what we are capable. He will give us a way of an escape. He will give us the good grace that we need. Okay, but the decision is ours. Our will is supreme. Our will is sovereign in the respect that, hey, we've got to decide what we're going to do, our own thing, or do what Christ wants us to do. Now, Christ says, hey, my grace is sufficient. It's here, you know, but you have to act on it. All right? So we have to act in such a way. And if we are acting on his grace, we won't sin. That's basically what it's saying. No one who abides in him sins, and no one who sins has seen him or knows him. Now, with that latter part, it says no one who sins, it means practices sin. Okay, because you got to put it in the context it's talking about. Because how many times did you use the word practice here? Because we all know that we sin. Because John even told us earlier on. He says, hey, we all sin. He says we shouldn't sin, but if anyone sins, we have an advocate before the Father. Remember reading that? So you got to take that verse in the line of this verse, and we understand that, well, what he's talking about here is that he's talking about a lifestyle of sin. Then he says in verse 7, it says, little children, let no one deceive you. The one who practices righteousness is righteous, just as he is righteous. Okay, here's the other side of the coin. If you are practicing righteousness, in other words, if you're always doing good, then here is what Jesus referred to when he said, by their fruits you shall know them. See, the world comes by and says, well, you're judging. You know, they point their long, bony finger in your face, accuse you of judging. When all you have to do is look at a person, you know, and look at their lifestyle or look at the way they're living, and you can pretty well see whether they're saved or not. Why? Because Jesus said, by their fruits you shall know them. Okay, you look at the apples on an apple tree. I mean, you'd have to be pretty demented to say, well, there's an orange tree, or there's a pear tree, you know, or that's a grapevine. I mean, it's obvious, isn't it? Or if you said, well, that's an apple tree, some fool says to you, well, you're judging.
No.
Well, what do you mean, I'm judging? That's just a fact, right? It's an apple tree, right? That's what it is. Right. You should be more tolerant. You know, it's just simply, hey, you can tell a tree by its fruits. That's what Jesus said. right? You're going to know them, whether you're saved or lost. I mean, you know, a person comes out from robbing a bank, I'm not going to say, well, there goes a Christian. He just, you know. You say, well, that guy's on his way to hell. Oh, you're judging. Well, I mean, you know, I'm giving you a prank. I mean, isn't there
a,
yeah.
There is a difference, though, between saying that person is on their way to hell by their lifestyle and saying that person's going to hell.
Yeah. You know, yeah. And, yeah, right, I see what you're saying. Well, like I just said, they're on their way to hell.
Sure.
Let's say.
Right. I mean, okay. One is the end result, you're judging.
Right.
You don't know that.
Right.
One is, by the fruits, he's on his way.
Right.
That's a change.
Exactly. Exactly. Good point. In verse 8, it says, the one who practices the sin of the devil. Now, that's a pretty profound statement, isn't it? Remember Jesus, when he was dealing with the scribes and the Sadducees and the Pharisees in his day, you know, he looked them square in the eye and says, your father is the devil. I mean, you know, that went over like a lead balloon. I mean, what would Jesus say to the Supreme Court justices, to our President of the United States, about partial abortion or abortion in general? I mean, you know, he's going to say, oh, well, you know, it's a choice. Get a life. He ain't going to say that. He's going to say it's murder and your father's the devil and you're on the way to hell unless you get this squared away. Well, he says, hey, if they hated me, they'll hate you. And that's what's happening today, right? So it says, in verse 8 says, the one who practices sin is of the devil, for the devil has sinned from the beginning. Okay, I want to say something about this. Devil has sinned from the beginning, okay? Now, I know there's some people that believe, and I don't want to, you know, get off on a tangent here, but they believe, that God created the devil, you know, the way he is. Because it says this verse here, you know, the devil sinned from the beginning. But what that's simply saying is that the devil means what? The devil means accuser or slanderer. But what was Satan's original name? Lucifer. What did Lucifer mean? Star of the morning or light bearer. It means light bearer. And I think, you know, I just want to share with you what Isaiah said. I'm just going to read it quickly. What he said in Isaiah 14. You don't have to turn there. But he said this. He says, how have you fallen from heaven, O star of the morning, son of the dawn? His name means star of the morning, son of the dawn. He's a light bearer. His name is Lucifer. God did not create him as the devil. Okay? How have you fallen from heaven, O star of the morning, son of the dawn? You have been cut down to the earth, you who have weakened the nations, but you said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars, God. I will sit on the mount of the assembly in the recesses of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. Nevertheless, you will be thrust down to Sheol or to hell, to the recesses of the pit. Those who see you will gaze at you and ponder you, saying, okay, no, I won't go any further than that. But remember Jesus had said, that he said, I saw Satan fall from heaven as light, as lightning, as a lightning bolt. And in Ezekiel, in the 28th chapter, this is what it says of the devil. I won't read the whole thing, but he says, again, the word of the Lord came to me, saying, son of man, take up a lamentation over the king of Tyre and say to him, thus saith the Lord. Now, the king of Tyre, in various portions of Scripture, you know, when a man is leading the nation, he can be referred to as a king. But in this context, there was the prince of Tyre, which was the man leader, but then there's a king of Tyre. Stop and think about it for a minute. What I mean by this, okay? All right. Remember when there was this situation in the book of Daniel, where Daniel was fasting for 3 weeks and praying for guidance and wisdom and for an interpretation of a vision, and when he was praying, God immediately sent an angel to answer Daniel's prayer about the interpretation of a vision. But this particular angel was thwarted for 3 weeks by who?
The Prince of Persia.
Prince of Persia, which was a demon, okay? And this prince of Persia was so powerful that this angel couldn't get through. And now this angel that was trying to get through with Daniel, when he appeared to Daniel, he was so glorious to Daniel that Daniel fell at his feet as a dead man. I mean, Daniel just had his breath taken away, and he just slammed to the floor because this angel was so magnificent. But this angel, in spite of all of his magnificence, he couldn't get through to Daniel. Because the prince of Persia, a demon, a fallen angel, was thwarting him. And it wasn't until Michael the archangel, God finally said, hey, send Michael, go help that guy get through, that angel get through. So when Michael came, okay, the angel, you know, they overwhelmed the prince of Persia, and the angel got through to Daniel. But then, just before the angel was to leave, he says, you know, I'm going back. He says, but I'm going to have to fight again the prince of Persia. And he says, here comes the prince of Greece. He says, only Michael's able to stand strong against them. So in other words, over every single nation, there is a prince, a demonic prince. And the king over all these nations of the world is the devil. Okay? So what it's saying here is talking in spiritual terms. All right? When he says this, again the word of the Lord came to me saying, Son of man, take up a lamentation over the king of Tyre and say to him, Thus saith the Lord God, You had the seal of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. You were in Eden, the garden of God, and every precious stone which you're covering, the ruby and the topaz and the diamond and the beryl, the onyx and the jasper and the lapis and the loop, the emerald and the gold workmanship of your setting and your sockets was in you. On the day that you were created, they were prepared. You were the anointed cherub. Now, granted, see, he's talking about a king here, but he's referring to him as a cherub. He's referring to him as an angel, the anointed angel. It says, you were the anointed cherub who covers or who guards. And I placed you there, and you were on the holy mountain of God, and you walked in the midst of the stones of fire. You were blameless in your ways. Okay, now I want to make this emphasis. You were blameless in your ways. God did not create the devil as he is today. He was created perfect in wisdom. He was blameless in his ways from the day that you were created until unrighteousness was found in you. By the abundance of your trade, you were internally filled with violence and you sinned. Therefore, I have cast you as profane from the mountain of God, and I have destroyed you, O covering cherub. From the midst of the stones of fire, your heart was lifted up because of your beauty, and you corrupted your wisdom by reason of your splendor. I cast you to the ground. And remember what Jesus said, I saw Satan fall from heaven as a bolt of lightning. I cast you to the ground. I put you before kings that they may see you. By the multitude of your iniquities and in the unrighteousness of your trade, you profaned your sanctuaries. Therefore, I have brought fire from the midst of you. I have consumed you and have turned you to ashes on earth in the eyes of the... And so on and so forth. I just share that with you because what we're reading here, when he's saying, it was verse 8, okay, it says, the one who practices sin is of the devil, for the devil has sinned from the beginning. So I just want to emphasize that, okay, that he sinned from the beginning. The beginning of what? The beginning of his fall. As soon as he was cast out of heaven, you know, he has sinned ever since. When he was thrown, as he is on his way down, like at the speed of light, out of heaven and into hell, his nature was changed. He went from this glorious being to this hideous monster. And he has been ever since. Anyway, he says that verse 8, he says, the one who practices sin is of the devil, for the devil has sinned from the beginning. The Son of God appeared for the purpose that he might destroy the works of the devil. No one who is born of God practices sin because his seed abides in him, and he cannot sin because he is born of God. Now, it's saying that no one who is born of God practices sin. All right. If we have God's seed, well, in other words, God's spirit. We all have God's spirit. If we've been born again, we have God's spirit in us. But God doesn't control us in the sense that, you know, we are become robots. Right. All right. His spirit was there, and if we yield to his spirit, we will not sin. That's basically what it's saying. And in verse 10, it says, by this the children of God and the children of the devil are obvious. Anyone who does not practice righteousness is not of God, and the one who does not love his brother is not of God. Okay, that's the kind of acid test. You got to do righteousness and love your brother. Even in James, he says, hey, what's the source of quarrels among you, brethren? What is it? Anybody remember what he says in the book of James? He says, you lust and you do not have, so you murder to get what you want. Okay, and you rather than ask God. And he says, even when you ask God, you ask with the wrong motive, so you don't get what you want. In other words, all these wars, you know, if you cut through all the claptrap, the bottom line is that somebody's lusting after something that doesn't belong to them. Mm-hmm. And they covet it. They want it. Therefore, they murder to get it. Yeah. He said, that's the real source of all your quarrels. Okay, it's when you lust after what you don't have. And, you know, rather than looking to God and asking for what you need, you know, you fight and you quarrel and you kill to get it. But even if you ask, he says a lot of times you ask with the wrong motives, you're not going to get it anyway. He says, you know, rather than spend it on your own lust. Okay, so, you know, he kind of puts it in a nutshell. Why is there so much hatred among people today? Because, you know, the source of their quarrels is they lust after what they don't have. Okay? And then it says, verse 11, for this is the message which you have heard from the beginning, that we should love one another, not as Cain, who was of the devil, who was of the evil one, and slew his brother. For what reason did he slay him? Because his deeds were evil and his brothers were righteous. Okay, he's talking about Cain here. Well, I talked about it earlier, mentioned earlier in this letter that I just read to you about Cain. Okay, you know, Cain slew his brother. Why? Because he was envious of his brother. Cain's deeds were evil. And he slew his brother because his brother's deeds were righteous. And it really bugged him and annoyed him. I think it's kind of interesting. You look at you look at Jesus hanging on a cross and the two thieves beside him. Okay? It's almost as though the world cannot tolerate the really evil people and the really good people. They're going to crucify them both. Why? Because the world can't stand either one of them. You know, I don't know if you're following my drift here, okay? But it kind of fits in what we were talking about when it says that when we talk about Cain. Cain slew his brother because why? Because he couldn't tolerate, you know, his brother's righteousness. Okay, verse 13 says, "Do not marvel, brethren, if the world hates you. You know that we have passed out of death and into life because we love the brethren. He who does not love abides in death." And Jesus himself said, "By this moment all men know that you are my disciples, if you love one another." Interesting that he didn't say, you know, if you agree on every particular doctrine that you can think of, but rather if you love one another. The true believer, he can transcend, you know, his particular denomination in a sense and encompass all believers in Christ. Very narrow-minded believers, it's like they can't accept other Christians if they don't hold exactly to every little doctrine that they have, every marginal peripheral doctrine. As long as we can maintain the basics as far as doctrine, then we do have a common denominator in which to fellowship. But the only way the world's going to know that we are Christians is if we love one another. And so he says in that in verse 15, every one who hates his brother is a murderer, and you know that no murderer has eternal life abiding in him. Now it's talking about hate. Jesus himself referred to this. He says, you heard it written, thou shalt not kill, but I say unto you, if you are even angry with your brother in your heart, you're guilty of murder. He said, if you say to your brother, Raca, or thou fool, in other words, if you have a contemptuous spirit towards anyone for any reason, you're guilty of murder in God's eyes. That's a pretty high order, isn't it? And it's pretty tough, you know, when you deal with certain people. But I know myself, you know, there's certain people that it would be very easy for me to foment a lot of hatred or animosity or resentment or contempt for. But whenever I have to deal with something like that, I make a very special effort to keep that person in my prayers, to pray for that person's spiritual and physical and temporal well-being, you know, to pray for the person and to go out of my way to just simply be congenial to the person because I know that, hey, I do not want to foment, you know, a spirit of resentment or hatred or animosity towards this person, because if I do, it's in God's eyes, I'm a murderer. Okay, I tell you what, let's just finish reading these last concluding verses. We'll read them all together and then we'll just comment on them before we close. Now, beginning with verse 16, it says, "We know love by this, that he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. But whoever has the world's goods and beholds his brother in need and closes his heart against him, how does the love of God abide in him? Little children, let us not love with word or with tongue, but in deed and truth. We shall know this, that we are of the truth, and shall assure our hearts before him in whatever our heart condemns us, for God is greater than our heart and knows all things. Beloved, if our heart does not condemn us, we have confidence before God, and whatever we ask, we receive of him, because we keep his commandments and do the things that are pleasing in his sight. And this is the commandment that we believe in the name of his Son, Jesus Christ, and love one another just as he has commanded us. And the one who keeps his commandments abides in him, and he in him. And we know this. And we know by this that he abides in us by the Spirit of which he has given us." Okay, you know, I really wish we had more time to expound upon this, but just in highlighting and briefing what he in these concluding verses, that verse 23, and this is the commandment that we have. We believe in the name of his Son, Jesus Christ, and we love one another just as he has commanded. You know, if we obey that first part of the commandment is very, very, it's the most essential. First of all, he's commanded us what? That we believe on his Son. Okay? Too many people today think that, well, I'm basically a good person, therefore, you know, if there's a heaven, I'm going to go there. Right? Well, you have, first of all, you're not a good person, and second of all, you have to believe on his Son. Okay? Because that is a command. If you, God has commanded us to do that. It's not an option. You know, people don't see this. I mean, when it comes to Jesus Christ, he said, Jesus Christ said, I am the way, the truth, the life. No man comes to the Father except by me. It always intrigues me when some Christian evangelist or some visible Christian comes out and says something to the effect that, hey, you know, that if unless you accept Jesus Christ, you know, you're not saved. And then there's a bunch of people up in arms about that. Those are Jesus' words. Those aren't any man's words. Okay, this is something that God has commanded, all right, that we believe on his Son. And if we don't obey that command, then it's impossible for us to obey the second part of that command, which is what? To love one another. We can have sentimental feelings for one another, but if we're really going to love one another sacrificially, it's going to take what? It's going to take a divine love. It's going to take God's Spirit working within us to enable us to do that. Does anybody have anything want to add or share to what we read tonight?
No.